Welcome back, guys. DGS 204. Going to get some rain coming through here. Evidently, there it is. It's going right now downtown. Supposed to all be gone by game time tonight. And then tomorrow, as you heard, is going to be very pretty. Chet Pleven is going to be joining us quite a bit over the next few weeks because Donald Trump, of course, is on trial and he is keeping track of it for us. Hello, Chet.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Good. So today was the second day of testimony with David Pecker, right, David? And he was the head of National Enquirer. And tell us what the prosecution, you think, what strategy they're trying to get out of this individual and how well it's going.
Well, what they did today through his testimony is that they used David Pecker to drag both Trump as well as Michael Cohen into the conspiracy to influence the election. And so the way that, and that's significant, that's important, because before you had Trump on the kind of suggesting that he was on the outside looking in. He really didn't know anything about what was going on. Well, what David Pecker testified to today was that in August of 2015, he got a phone call from Michael Cohen, inviting him to meet both Michael Cohen as well as Donald Trump at a meeting. And that was at the start of the campaign. And what they wanted to know was whether or not David Pecker, who was an all-time friend back into the 1980s of Donald Trump, whether or not he, through his National Enquirer sleazy publication, could in any respect help them with their campaign. And what they wanted from him and what they said at the meeting was that they wanted him to publish positive stories about Trump and negative stories about his opponents. And Pecker at that time said he could be essentially the eyes and the ears for Donald Trump during the course of the campaign. Now, the significance of the National Enquirer, although it's a sleaze bucket magazine, okay, everybody sees it. You've seen it. If you've gone to the grocery store, you've seen the National Enquirer as you're checking out. You've got your groceries there, you're waiting in the checkout line, and you look and you see the headline. Now, you probably have never even looked inside the newspaper, but you can see the headline, and they generate a lot of attention through those headlines. So this was really something that was really, really important to the campaign. And so what Pecker also did was he established the role through his testimony today, the role that Michael Cohen played, the significant role that Michael Cohen played during the course of the campaign. And he had multiple instances where he contacted Cohen and Cohen would contact him. Cohen would tell him about negative stories. Cohen would tell him about what they wanted him to run, what kind of sleazy story they wanted him to run. And the jury got the benefit of actually seeing some of those stories. Those stories included negative stories, not only about his opponents, his Democratic opponents, but about his opponents within his own party. For example, when they felt that Cruz, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio were gaining some popularity, they fed Pecker some stories about them, and Pecker would run those stories. Also of significance, Pecker said that he knew well Donald Trump, and he knew, his own knowledge and information, and actually witnessed Donald Trump being frugal and cautious. He saw specifically with his own eyes, saw Donald Trump review invoices and sign checks, not as a matter of just routine. He would analyze. He would look at what the invoice said. He would look at what the check said. And he witnessed that firsthand. So that plays into the question of, well, okay, if you're so frugal, And why are you paying $130,000 and then you're increasing that to $420,000 that you're paying Michael Cohen under the guise of some sort of legal fees that you're paying him for, not reimbursement for paying $130,000 to Stormy Daniels? So he also said that prior to 2015 and prior to that August 2015 meeting that he had with Trump and Cohen, that the Inquirer never purchased any kind of a story about Trump not to print. And so the idea was that they would be alerted, and Pecker warned Cohen and warned Trump, there are going to be people out there who, females, that may try to peddle and sell some stories that aren't favorable to you during the course of this campaign. And essentially, you know, let us know, and we may want to buy those stories. Thus led to the catch and kill stories. He didn't get, I mean, he's probably going to be on the witness stand for another day, Pecker is, and of course the cross-examination hasn't occurred yet, but they also recounted the story of paying the doorman at Trump Tower $30,000 to silence him with respect to his contention that Donald Trump fathered a child out of wedlock. And the interesting part about that, and Trump, I suppose, is going to be suggesting that, well, you know, a lot of this stuff I wanted to keep away from my wife, didn't want her to know about Karen McDougal and didn't want her to know about Stormy Daniels. But according to Pecker, there was a non-disclosure agreement that Michael Cohen said, well, after the election, it's okay. You know, we can release him from whatever agreement that they had. So this is all pretty significant. And in just, you know, a couple of hours worth of testimony, Pecker established a pretty beneficial relationship that existed between Trump and the National Enquirer. And then now coming into play, and I suppose whenever he testifies again, you're going to have the situation, the Karen McDougal situation, where she was paid $150,000 to keep quiet during the course of the campaign. So, and then, of course, I suppose when Michael Cohen testifies, you're going to have the situation where Cohen had to go take a mortgage out on his condo or his apartment or whatever it might be to pay off Stormy Daniels, because in the catch and kill with respect to the doorman, the $30,000, Pecker paid that, and with respect to Karen McDougal, Pecker paid the $150,000 and was never reimbursed by Donald Trump, and that's why he wouldn't pay the $150,000, or the Inquirer wouldn't pay the $130,000 for Stormy Daniels, and that's why Cohen had to figure out how to pay her off because Pecker wasn't paying anymore.
So, Chad, all of that is, like you said, very slimy and sleazy and makes Donald Trump look terrible. Is any of it illegal? And do you feel like they're building a good, solid foundation to get to the illegal stuff?
I do. As I said yesterday, I think that they told a good story during the opening statement. But now what they have to do is when the jury instructions come along, and that's the court telling these jurors what the law of the case is. The jury, as you know, they decide the facts, but the jury doesn't decide what the law is. They get the law from the court. And so one of the instructions is going to be that there has to be an intent to further other crimes beyond saying that I'm reimbursing, or I'm not reimbursing, but I'm paying Michael Cohen just for legal fees to the tune of $420,000. So there has to be something else, some other reason why he would falsify that business record. And that's the intent that they have to find was to commit the other crime, which could have been a campaign finance law violation or some sort of tax law violation. So, you know, it's one thing to call this, you know, to influence the election. And I think, as the defense said during the course of their opening statement, well, you know, everybody tries to influence an election. Hopefully you don't do it in an illegal manner, but you're trying to influence the election favorable to your client. There's really nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong. Had they paid off Stormy Daniels and they had a non-disclosure agreement, there's absolutely nothing illegal about that. But that's not how they did it. The way in which the prosecution claims that they did it, and the way in which they plan to prove it, is to say that the reason that Cohen paid her off and the reason that they listed that as a business expense, the actual reimbursement for that payoff, was that was the illegality. So had they done it correctly, had they done it just straight out and paid her, keep your mouth shut, we don't want you saying anything in the election, that would have been fine. That would have been absolutely fine. So once you when you take out the fact that he claimed in his business record that that was monies that Cohen earned, that's the illegality. And obviously, if he's claiming that as salary to Michael Cohen, that's taxable. So had he reimbursed Michael Cohen, all he would have to do is reimburse him $130,000, which is what he paid to Stormy Daniels. He wouldn't have to pay him anything else beyond that. So, but he did. So they set that up as Pecker's testimony. Well, this guy's frugal. You know, this guy is cautious with his money. He's not writing checks just for no reason for $420,000 or $130,000. He's got a purpose to it all. He didn't repay Pecker for the $30,000 that they paid to the doorman and $150,000 that they paid to Karen McDougal. So all of that has to tie together at the end. And as I said, it's a pretty compelling story. And when you stop and think, well, wait a minute, you don't care what they talk about after the election. And she's paid, Stormy Daniels is paid 2 weeks before the election, but Cohen isn't reimbursed until after the election. You know, all of it comes into play circumstantially. You know, are you ever going to have? And they apparently the scheme for the $130,000 is Alan Weiselberg. That it's in his handwriting, that scheme. Now that hasn't come out yet, and they haven't introduced that yet. But apparently that's in his handwriting, that scheme, and how they're going to handle Stormy Daniels and the $130,000. So again, that's part of the conspiracy. So you have Pecker, you have Trump, you have Cohen, you have Alan Weiselberg, you have, you know, catch and kill, and you have three instances of catch and kill that benefit Donald Trump and benefit that campaign. And then on top of that, you have Michael Cohen being paid for fees or for income or for salary that he never got before in that amount of money. Historically, I think they'll be able to prove. So add it all up, and you know, then it becomes more than just a misdemeanor that you messed up your business records and you falsified your business records, which unto itself too would have been okay. That's a misdemeanor. You know, what's the big deal on a misdemeanor? Of course, I guess if you're running for president, it is a big deal. But beyond that, it's certainly less serious than a felony, than 34 felony offenses. So.
All right, buddy. That is a great summation. We will look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Thank you, Chet.
You bet, Dave.
224 DGS. So, Rach, this is usually the kind of question I'd be afraid to ask, but it's on your Google Doc. What is a puppy girl?
Oh, my goodness. So a puppy girl is an influencer who acts like a puppy in kind of like a sexual way. There's a puppy girl who has like 160,000 followers on Instagram, and she acts like a dog. And
what's she influencing?
She's, I mean, I'm
weird
like,
dudes.
Yeah.
But I mean, is she like, puppy girls love Crest?
You know, Dave, I didn't go to her account. Maybe I should have. Maybe I should have seen the type of products she's endorsing. But I mean, I'm assuming once you get to that many followers, you're making money off of the account. I mean, I don't think she's doing puppy girl stuff out of the kindness of her heart.
Right.
I think she's getting paid.
Right.
So, they act like doggies. And, you know, you
is
throw
this
the
new?
I guess it's relatively new. I mean, you know, they always say there's nothing new under the sun. So maybe women have been doing this for millennia and we just have had no idea. But it's on the internet now.
I feel pretty good that I'm not getting puppy girls on my TikTok feed.
You will now.
Now that you said it out loud.
You're probably right.
Your phone just heard us talking about it.
Sorry to the entire DGS listening audience.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
100,000 phones.
Yeah, puppy girl's about to get a lot more followers.
That's on me. Sorry, guys.
Jeez. And your take on service workers?
Okay, so I went and I got my oil changed today, and the guys who did it were just so great. And I got upset thinking that people would be mean to them.
Uh-huh.
Like, even if the service didn't go the way you want it to go, in general, these people are working harder than me in my cushy office job, you know? Like, you're on your feet all day, you're thinking all day, you're directing people, you're customer-facing, so you have to... Even if you're a bad mood. Exactly. And it's like, if you get bad service somewhere, I mean, unless someone's just being out and out rude to you and mean.
Yeah.
But get mad at the corporation for not staffing enough people rather than taking it out on the people who are on the front lines, just trying to make sure you get your Jamba juice or whatever you're upset about that
day.
Yeah,
right.
Just the kind of thing that I, you know, just got me thinking this morning. And I thought, we just all need to be better about that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have a hot take about service industry and service people.
Let's hear it.
Oh, they need to shut their mouths. No, I'm kidding. I think if you come in and you're rude to them, I think they should be allowed to be rude back.
That's what it was like at my Radio Shack, which I feel comfortable talking about this because it no longer exists. But my manager was always he wasn't like, be mean back, but he would stand up for us and like kind of not take anybody's crap. And that, it was very empowering. It was nice just knowing that people weren't going to just walk
Mr.
all
Donut.
Over you.
Was it?
Really?
Mr. Donut, there was no crap that you weren't allowed to take.
For an extra 50 cents, you could yell at the kid making donuts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of your hot take. I think if you treat people poorly, they should be able to give you back what you're serving.
I wasn't sure if you guys would agree or not.
No.
So that's, okay.
I'm as a former waiter, as a former server, whatever you called it.
But it's all in the definition. It's all in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
What you think someone's giving you crap.
That's
I might watch it and go like, well, no, they just want their burger.
I specifically thought of it as like, I mean, you know, I'll get calls from people sometimes who just want to like cuss and, you know, be objectively mean.
Puppy girls mostly?
Yeah. It's not bad.
Woof,
look,
woof.
I didn't say I don't
woof,
like
woof,
it.
Woof, woof, and woof.
I didn't say I don't like it. But no, like those kind of people, like the people that you know, the kind of people that you see at a restaurant sometimes and you're like, well, this guy's just a jerk.
Yeah, I hear you. 234 DGS. Before we jump into the audio, this has a St. Louis connection because of Matt Holiday, but his son, who's
Jackson,
the stud of all studs, but
number
he's
one prospect in baseball coming into the year.
Really bad start.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like 1-for-30, bunch of strikeouts. I mean, look, here's the thing. Less than 2 years ago, he was still in high school. Right. I mean, like, that's the thing that people need to kind of grasp when we're talking about it. But I'm fascinated when this kind of thing happens, because when it happens somewhere else and not with your team, it provides perspective. Right. So Victor Scott got the call up and he struggled really badly, and he's going back down to work to come back. That's not unusual. Aaron Judge had to do that. Mike Trout had to do that when he first came up, and you know, they came up, they struggled, they went back down, came back, and fine. But when it's the team that you're around the most, it's like, oh, see, another one of their prospects fails. Always happens with this team. But the point is, it's happening everywhere. Jackson Holliday was the number one pick in the draft. He was the number one prospect in baseball coming into this year. He's the son of a major leaguer, and he's going to be just fine. But he's young, and he's not done this before, and he's off to a terrible start. And he'll probably have to go back to the minors. It's no big deal. It happens all the time. But we blow up more about it when it's our team as opposed to when it's happening somewhere else. Fascinating thing.
I don't know if there's any way of you knowing this, but I'm curious about your gut. There are all strata of sports people. There are people like me who are passionate about it, but not super well informed. I don't check the box scores.
Right, right.
And then there are people who live and die, and they keep score at home on their little, you know, score sheet. Do you think people are more or less informed about sports than they have been in the past?
I think way more, but a lot of people choose not to look at things, right? I mean, like, I think that if you want it, it's there. Do you want to know whether or not there are good things happening? You can find it. Not only statistics, right? You can find numbers that we never had access to before. You can find out how hard somebody's hitting. As an example, Jackson Holliday, he's been a terrible hitter. He's been a phenomenal fielder. You can go find that out with one click in one place to see how's he doing offensively, how's he doing defensively, how's his base running, and you can figure all these things out. Where before you're just eyeballing it, and everybody's eyeballs are different. They come with different biases, different opinions, different views of what something should look like. It's there for you, but also it's not just that, it's coverage. Like, you can see all kinds of outlets covering these professional teams. So if you want to know more, you definitely know more.
Let's do some audio, Rich.
All right, let's start with mine. I have here some audio from the world's first fully AI-generated film.
So, Claire, what's your stuff?
The City of Lights. I'm hoping it's a new start.
I don't think we have to pray for long.
Maybe you're the dark, mysterious kind of man who never shows his vulnerability.
Got a feeling that the wait is over.
Maybe you're the kind of woman who's never sure of what you want, even if it's right in front of you.
This reminds me of Chris Ranji's sexual harassment video.
You know what, AI is saying the stuff that's supposed to be subtle and quiet out loud.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right? Oh, like, you take the cues of what we would see, like, oh, that's she's the quiet type, right?
They're talking in flirt language.
Right.
As if, like, it's not flirt language.
Right. It's very weird.
It's called Next Stop Paris, and it's a short AI-generated rom-com featuring professional voice actors and an original script, but the imagery was generated with AI tools.
Oh wait, a human wrote the script?
Wow.
Apparently so.
And humans said those words?
Apparently so.
And it was supposed to be funny?
That's a whole different story.
Were they 12?
That was a it was funny. I just didn't realize it was a comedy.
It's coming out this summer. If you'd like to see it, Next Stop Paris.
Man, I thought this for sure, like, the bots wrote that because they don't understand human emotion or gestures or body language. Oh, my goodness.
Have you seen the animated ongoing things that have been made by AI where they're trying to convince us it's real? And they're trying to convince us that, like, all animated movies in the future will be AI. And it's this stupid, like, princess looking cartoon in a red dress, and it's so.
I heard about the girl in the red dress.
Yeah, she's like, I'm Princess Smelly, and I have many powers.
Princess Smelly?
Her name's not Princess Smelly. I didn't even know
that's what you said.
It is what I said. I said not what her name is, but she, and then she, like,
should be,
just like disappears and then reappears. I have many powers like this, and it's like, come on, don't insult me. Don't insult me and tell me.
I'm telling
me
you,
that this
AI is going to go so badly, and I don't
at
just
first.
Mean I don't mean just badly as in, like, they make us our pets. I just mean I think it's going to be annoying from the jump.
Yeah, especially
it's annoying
at
me.
First.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be a lot. I'm stunned that was a human that wrote that as opposed to the AI. But at first, I think it's going to feel like. 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds telling you what things are, right? Like, that's the perspective they're going to have, the perspective of a child, but yet the ability to access information, but they don't know what it means or context or anything like that.
Wheels, you have some audio here from a pastor.
Yeah, so this was interesting to me. I don't remember the pastor's name, but this is described as a conservative pastor who is very upset about the meshing of politics and religion.
Some of you bring politics into the church. You think that politics is spiritual stuff. Politics is of this world. You think it's your duty to be political about this, that, and the other. No, your duty is to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, body, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Wow. There's a Bible out now that includes the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Isn't that wonderful? No. No, it's disgusting. It's blasphemous. It's a ploy Are you kidding me? Some of you are so encouraged by that.
So, A, that's the kind of preacher I would be if I were a fake preacher that was yelling around. But I thought those were interesting points. Like, it's interesting because it's about the separation of church and state, but from the religious viewpoint.
Yeah.
That these things are not supposed to be connected.
Yeah. I mean, what I took from his message, and I heard even more of his message than what we played there, is that politics could not be more of the world.
Right, right.
And you need to concern yourself with the next world, not this one. At least in
your
that
spirit.
Way.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's not, he's not saying
render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Basically,
kind of
it's that. Yeah, yeah, which was fascinating because so many now are blending the two.
Yeah.
And you wonder what the purpose is because clearly the two things aren't supposed to be blended.
Yeah, I'm not a Christian, but it makes me feel better about society when I hear Christians push back on Christian nationalism. Mm. I got no problem with Christianity. I have a problem with Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. So,
and Andrew has some sound from Costco.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, you know who I am.
I'm so sorry. I thought you were just wanting to play
it. So this is a guy who, I guess there's a conspiracy now about LED lights.
Oh, yeah. I saw this.
This guy is the best.
This guy doesn't
and by best, I mean weirdest and worst.
This guy doesn't want any LED lights on his chicken.
I don't want any trouble. I got 5 chickens. I don't want any LED on them. None. Scan my shirt 5 times, buddy. 5 times. I don't want to charge it on this car. I want to put it on this car. Scan it.
I think he's a TikTok.
Scan it.
I did.
Okay. Done.
This guy has the barcodes for the chicken printed on his shirt.
He has printed the chicken barcode on his shirt. And so he's like, do not scan my chickens with the LED and infect them with the LED lights. Scan my shirt 5 times. And sure enough, when he scanned it, it brought up Costco chicken.
Couldn't have just put it on a piece of paper? You had to have a T-shirt made?
Yeah, this guy's nuts when you look at him. Like, this guy's definitely, he's buying the conspiracies.
Do we know what the conspiracy about the LED?
I don't know. It's isn't it, Andrew, related to like the light bulb conspiracy that like they're trying to replace incandescent bulbs with LED because somehow LED is going to make you more compliant or something like that.
It's not dissimilar.
But I don't know how it figures in with dead chickens.
I've become considerably more liberal since I started shopping at IKEA.
Yeah. Here's what's so sad about that. Not to make it all serious, but my mom has lost about 80% of her cognition since her fall. Mm. And so when I talk to her now, she makes sense in the context of her world.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
She doesn't understand the reality of the world, but in her own world that she's living in her mind, things make sense. And having gone through this with my dad 20 years ago, you either fight back against it. No, 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 no. You're in a hospital in XYZ. Or you just say like, no, mom, you didn't spend the night outside last night. You're perfectly warm and cozy in here. You know, this guy believes that the LED is going to do something to him or the chicken to such a degree that he had a shirt made. Like, it's funny, and I think it's funny too, but it's sad that whatever has gone askew in this guy's brain, he is completely convinced of this. Well, he thinks we're the saps.
Well, and the problem, though, is that there are so many people that believe this nonsense. And I mean, clearly, if you look at it, like you step back and you look at it rationally, there are people out there that know guys like this are susceptible and they push these things. The Alex Joneses of the world who are going to get wealthy off of it.
They sell them testosterone pills.
That's right. They get wealthy knowing that people have these types of issues when it comes to believing in various things and they exploit them.
249 DGS. Time to talk to our pal Rick Horton. Hey, Rick.
How are you, Dave? Good to talk to you.
Good. Better after last night. It's just nice to win.
It felt normal, didn't it? I mean, there's something normal about that. I mean, the crowd was amped up. The homers late by Goldie and Gorman, they needed it so desperately. If you could have written a script and said, who needs that better than, more than anybody in that clubhouse to have a big moment. You just said those two guys, so it was very, very cool.
No doubt. And, you know, anyone who's ever played sports, and I'm talking about people out there who played Quarry League, we all know what it's like to be snake bit. We all know what it's like to miss the first ground ball and know that, please don't hit the ball to me. Please don't hit the ball to me because I'm going to miss it again. I'm sure that's not how Goldie is because he's a professional and a future Hall of Famer, but we all know that feeling.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know that feeling absolutely as a baseball player, and you know, and the players sometimes, as a former player, and guys get frustrated by, you know, kind of, well, you know, you're looking for some crazy magic bullet answer, like I got to work harder, I got to move my hands here, and that's not really what it is. Now, it's interesting. I know that about baseball, but if I'm watching basketball, I say, how can that dude not make a free throw? I mean, and so you get that same thing in other sports you're not as familiar with where you kind of wonder, why is this seemingly so hard? But honestly, it is.
Ricky, when you look at it, I think we probably talked about this on some level throughout last year, but early this year, there are a few people struggling. And I know a lot of times it's hard as an outside observer to avoid trying to connect things. But when things go well, do you think there can be connections for them where guys start to feel better? Things start to roll a little better, but basically, I guess what I'm asking you is momentum actually a thing from game to game, or is it the old cliche that it's only as good as your next day's starter?
Yeah, I think momentum's not quite the word, Kevin, and you know, sometimes it's good to rehash what we talked about last year, because last year was a blur to me, frankly, all of the struggles that we had. But the point is, it's a feel that you get where it becomes natural and you do it without thinking about it. You know, the guy to get the yips, let's talk about the extreme, where you can't throw a pitch over the plate or you can't throw the ball to first base, you have the yips, or putting that way. I mean, that's where, you know, you're kind of overthinking. The opposite of that is you do it without thinking about it, and when you're hot, that's what happens. You are just naturally swinging on the right plane. You're naturally timed up. You're naturally loaded up, and the same goes for pitching.
And you know what? I don't care if you are a future Hall of Famer. When you start a new season and you look up at that scoreboard and it's all zeros, it's just tough.
So I don't know if you guys remember. I mean, you got to have to go way back for this one. I think it was 1986. We started out, you know, the whole team was 0 for April. I mean, it was terrible. and Whitey Herzog ordered the stadium ops people to not put the averages up on the board because he didn't want his players looking at him. I mean, that's how bad it was for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season. It would be, you know, now batting Willie McGee, and it'd be like, well, what's his batting average? We don't know, but probably not very good. So, but his idea was once you start getting that in your mind, then it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And what is that? What is the equivalent for pitchers, Rick?
Yeah, well, everybody, you know, people that say, hey, what's up? I always used to say my slider and my ERA. I mean, honestly, I knew my ERA all the time, and if I didn't get it below a certain point, in my mind it had to be under 3. If I didn't get it under 3, I was grouchy a little bit, and I realized I had. But I definitely knew where it was, and I realized that, hey, it's my job to not give up runs. I better get better at it.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way, too, because I've had a bunch of guys, friends of mine, people that have played in the big leagues, especially relievers, one or two bad games can mess that up for a really long time. And I guess turning that on this group, you're looking at a lot of low numbers with those guys in the bullpen, which means they haven't had those bad outings.
So the other thing you do is you play mind games. You're right. And I played mind games when I was starting. If I give up 4 runs in the first inning, I'd say, okay, I'm going to throw a 2-hitter the rest of the way. Or I'm not going to give up another run for 5. So you basically reset your goals within a game. I've done that, and you can certainly do it in a season.
Man, I know that, you know, when you're looking at how things have set up, Rick, the things that went wrong last year are not entirely the same things that are going wrong now, right? Last year, the bullpen was a problem. The bullpen's been fantastic this year. The pitching staff as a whole, I think, is 5th in the National League in earned run average. So that part is mission accomplished, but it's a whole new set of things and hopefully different guys to just get themselves sorted out as the season goes along.
And here's why I think it's different. When the pitching went south last year, and it went very far south, it went down to the equator south, there was no reason for optimism or hope. You didn't know who was coming back and was going to fix it. The hitting has gone south early on, but you have optimism that these guys are, because their track record shows that they're going to be better. So I don't think it's the same thing this year.
All right, buddy. Have a great game tonight.
You bet. Good to chat with you guys.